He got his PhD from Caltech and is currently a Pappalardo Fellow at MIT. He became well-known for his work on self-correcting quantum memories in three spatial dimensions, 3 + 1 dimensions, for those of you who like relativity. And today he's going to tell us about long-range entangled many-body states.
Thank you, Daniel.
Is your mic on?
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. Yes. My talk starts with a very grandiose title, but I will be very specific, so you don't have to be scared. It's a picture of a familiar hard disk drive. Although most of your laptops, it doesn't have that, actually. The modern solid-state disk drive actually works on a capacitor, not on this type of technology. But this is still important in a large cluster computing system or cloud computing, where you need a huge amount of storage. But what's going on microscopically? There is a sheet of magnetic material where some grains of material is polarized magnetically, and your read or write ahead goes over to detect the orientation of the magnetic field, and that's your 0 or 1, your bit information. If you zoom in further, then we can understand what the physics of that microscopic hard disk drive, and that is simply modeled by the well-known Ising model. You penalize anti-aligned spins and favor energetically aligned spins. Then whenever you have some domain of spins that are different from its environment, then there's an energy cost coming from its boundary interactions. And the crucial point is that as you increase the number of spins participating in that interaction, the energy penalty grows with the system size when you want to flip all of the spins by local moves. That is the physics of hard disk drive. And that encodes classical information reliably for many, many years. Although some of your hard disks may fail within like 5 years or so, but still it's a macroscopic time. And using that technology, I was able to bring this beautiful picture of Primitive Institute to you because it was stored in somewhere for a long, long time. Maybe the picture was taken like a year ago, so. Okay, so I make a metaphor to this writing and reading information storage technology to writing on a sand. I was able to write on a sand because sand is more or less reliable. But when the wind blows or water comes in, then it's wiped out. What you have to do is that you diligently write down your letters on the sand and monitor them so that it is not washed out. And that's actually what's going on in the experiment for the when it comes to the quantum information. You want to trap some number of ions in a periodic potential provided by the lasers. And then you want to keep that coherence for a long, long time, and you need that amount of equipment. That's very analogous to you keep track of sand writing and rewrite them. So why does it have to be so complicated? There's a very simple way that you don't have to wash your sand and just let it written for a long, long time. It's just that you spray out some salted water. By that means, I mean you increase the interaction between the granular of the sand so that you don't have to touch it. So if the sand is sticky, then your life is much more easier. So here is the challenge for the quantum information. We want to find some system where interaction, not isolation, protects quantum information. And well, it will reduce the experimental burden, and it might be a crucial technology for building a large-scale quantum computer, of course. And for this purpose, I claim that long-range entanglement will be necessary. So let's look at what entanglement can bring us. So, Let me start with a very basic example of Bell pairs. Bell pair is well known. You have two spins, say, or two photons, doesn't matter. And you prepare an entangled state. Entangled state can appear in various ways. For example, here you tune your plus or minus sign. And they are orthogonal states, so they are perfectly distinguishable. And Alice once finds one part of that Bell pair, and she finds that the part she gets from the Bell pair looks completely mixed. So she doesn't know what the sign information is. She can't tell the difference between the two states. So she asks, "Hey Bob, the state I got, does it come with the plus amplitude or minus relative amplitude?" Well, Bob says, "Well, I have examined the system. I have found that they are exactly the same to me. So I have really no idea." Okay. And Alice asks the same question because she learns a little bit more about quantum information. And she learns that it's kind of not only plus or minus sign is allowed, some arbitrary magnitude combination is also possible. So she asks again, "What's alpha?" And Bob answers, now Bob knows a little bit more than before, that he knows he cannot know. That's in principle forbidden because their reduced density matrices are identical. And it is irrespective of any phase information between the two. And we can push this story a little bit further. I mean, I want to actually hide all information about the amplitude from two parties. How can I do that? And this was designed by various people in the late 90s. And the way they do it is I declare that some state is a combination of 9-qubit state, where in this particular form, and we design an orthogonal state to orthogonal to that, and that comes with the minus sign, but I prepare 3 copies of them. And I take a linear combination of these two, and where alpha and beta now can be arbitrary. Now, Alice asks, does anyone know alpha or beta? Well, there are 9 Bobs now, and each of them answers, I don't know. The other side, I don't know either. But Alice insists that you must know because you are the total system. How can I, where should I find alpha and beta anywhere else? You should know. Oh, and Bob learns a little bit more about quantum mechanics and tells that when we 3 together, when we combine, then we can infer what the magnitude of alpha is. And the other 3 Bobs say, oh, they also know the magnitude of alpha. The same information, but different groups of Bobs. And the upper row 3 answers the same way. But what about phase? Phase is unknown to the horizontal group of Bobs, but they are known to the vertical groups of Bobs. But they only know the relative phase, not actually the magnitude. So the message here is that the global amplitude, alpha or beta, is accessible in multiple ways. And nothing is known to any individual Bobs. So we have succeeded to hide this alpha or beta from local observers. But as a consequence, actually, the information about alpha and beta must be accessible through multiple ways. Okay, so we have learned that entanglement is actually able to hide some degree of information, some degree of freedom from local observers. And as a consequence, that non-local information is spread out, and there you are provided with multiple ways of accessing it. And that's the underlying idea of fault-tolerant quantum computing. You don't manipulate your quantum information as a physical degree of freedom, but somehow you encode that information into a larger Hilbert space in such a way that any malicious observer we'll learn nothing, and we can act nothing on the encoded information. Okay, and as a physicist, we want them to be realized in some natural way. We don't want to do very hard engineering. We want them to be realized as a ground state of some local Hamiltonian. That's our physical interest. So we look into the ground states. So we go to two-dimensional lattices. Why am I skipping, say, one-dimensional lattices? That's another technical story, but I might not have time to come to that. But let's focus on the simplest two-dimensional lattices. So here's a way to obtain very interesting states. You superpose many configurations of qubits or spins. Let me say it's just qubits on a grid. And the rule is that you take superpositions of all possible configurations that corresponds to deformations by small loops. So here you had all spins up state. And by loop, I mean these four spins are flipped down, and these four are flipped down. And I say flipping four spins altogether amounts to deformation by small loop. And you take all possible such a combination, and you superpose them all with the equal amplitude. And if you consider this particular state, then the reduced density matrix, the linear functional that determines all the observables' expectation value at the local site, they are just completely mixed state. They are proportional to the identity. Okay, can we realize that as a ground state of local Hamiltonian? Yes, and the way it is done like this. So you introduce a product of four sigma x's, and that imposes that when this operator takes a plus one eigenvalue on the ground state, then that constraint gives rise to this condition that your loop, any flipped spin must be consist of even number at each vertex, which means it must be closed. And the other term is in the conjugate variable, sigma z, and that introduces deformations. You want it to have, say, if you want to have a plus one eigenvalue of this, then either there's a loop or not should come into with the equal amplitude. So I can think of this as a loop creation or an annihilation operator. And having a non-zero eigenvalue of this operator amounts to say that, oh, my state is a loop condensate. If you think of this further, then this state is not exhaustive that is allowed by this local Hamiltonian in the ground space. You can either have no loop, and then you create more small loops to fluctuate, or you could start with the state where one loop is going around all the lattice. And since small loops are fluctuating, whether there is a long loop going around the lattice is completely oblivious to the local observers. And likewise, you can introduce many more configurations. Well, in this particular case, there are four orthogonal states corresponding to the topology of the two-dimensional torus. So, and so we have succeeded to hide the information of the global parity of loops that goes around the torus from the local observers, but the existence of some loop going around some particular direction can be detected in multiple ways. Yes?
Just a question on terminology. When you say small loops, you mean those which do not go around the torus?
Yes.
They could be very large, but they...
Exactly. So, yeah.
Contractible loops.
Right. On this lattice, it's just a small pocket. That's it. Or any loop that is a combination of those small pockets. This is exactly reminiscent of the previous Alice and Bob story. We have hide the information about global parity of the loop winding number from the local observers, and as a consequence, that global winding number is measured through various ways, because you can always place Wilson loops at various locations. Okay, now, what do I mean by many-body entanglement? Let's get that concept more straight. If I take a region of some small size, say labeled by A, then entanglement entropy, a usual measure of entanglement, just gives you some area law. Is that a many-body? Well, this formula alone can be achieved by simply inserting many, many Bell pairs into your system. It doesn't seem to be anything to do with the truly many-body entanglement. You can arbitrarily achieve that, achieve this area law formula. Well, how about asking entanglement between two regions then? If I have two separate regions, A and B, and if I compute the reduced density matrix jointly, then on this particular state, this becomes just tensor product of the two local reduced density matrix. So by any definition of entanglement, the two regions are not entangled. Now, then we should go back to the fundamental. What's entanglement after all? Entanglement is actually an invariant under set of transformations. So we think of the Schmidt decomposition of a bipartite system, and we take an emphasis on this Schmidt coefficient. Why do we do that? Because they are the only invariant under basis change on either party. And in fact, the Schmidt coefficients determine the state up to local basis change. And that is the entanglement. And the famous von Neumann entropy, for example, is a function of those invariants. And why is it important? Because, well, there are many connections to other concepts in the information theory or thermodynamic quantity. But, but other than that, we don't have to really focus on this von Neumann entropy. The entanglement spectrum contains the more information. Now, when it comes to many-body entanglement, what should we ask? We have seen that the entanglement entropy itself doesn't tell you much. Many-body entanglement doesn't refer to the entanglement between two regions. Then what is it? Well, I said entanglement is an invariant under a set of transformations. And when it comes to bipartite, the set of transformations is the local basis change. And in the many-body system, we can resort to the locality. So we conceptually, we can say that the local entanglement can be washed away by some local basis change that acts on several set of qubits that are nearby. So we should declare, when we talk about entanglement, that entanglement of this state is equal to this, where the gray blob encoding the local basis change acting on those four qubits. And by transitivity of equivalence relation, we should declare that this state also is equivalent, has equivalent entanglement with that. So entanglement becomes, when it comes to many-body setting, is an equivalence class of states under a set of local unitary transformations. And by transitivity, we should say that local unitary transformation may become like this brick wall geometry, where, so this is a tilted view. This is top view, and this is side view. And we should say that whatever state that comes from product state and obtained after some set of finite number of layers of local unitary transformation, then we should say that it is unentangled from the perspective of many-body entanglement. And the negation of that, I would call that as a long-range entanglement. So I say a state is long-range entangled whenever the transformation circuit, I say it's a circuit because it resembles the circuit diagram in the computer science, where you think of this elementary unitary transformation as some and or not or operations. So whenever that circuit must be deep as a function of system size, then I say, oh, it has a long-range entanglement. So how, in practice, how do we show a state is long-range entangled? That's a very non-trivial question, actually. So suppose if some state, say on a torus, is equal to some small depth quantum circuit from the product state. Let's suppose that. So in other words, I suppose that psi naught is not long-range entangled. Then there's a special property of the product state that any orthogonal state to this must have a completely different local component, which means you can always detect that difference by some local observable. That's the special property of the product state. And that in turn, that any orthogonal state to psi naught must have some local observable, any orthogonal state to the psi naught must have some local observable that distinguish the two. Because small depth quantum circuit always maps a local operator to another local operator, although the support might get slightly enlarged. So if you started with the state psi naught that had a orthogonal, say, conjugate state, which is locally indistinguishable, then we can safely say that, oh, the state was long-range entangled. That's one criterion to tell about long-range entanglement. And that has a very interesting conservation law consequence as a consequence. So remember the original example where I just take the superposition of all possible small loops. And that system was on a torus. And imagine that I just cut the torus and make a cylinder. And if I had a loop, a long loop going around along, say, this direction, then on the cutted system, I would have this line going on. The small deformations will make this line fluctuate. But the fact that there is a long line going on will not be changed. And the presence of that can be detected by a Wilson loop going on the orthogonal direction. We can take a conformal transformation from this geometry to make a disk with a hole, and the presence of this open-ended string can be detected by this loop operator. Yeah, the presence of open end can be detected far away, and there are multiple ways to detect it. In other words, whatever you do at the end, as long as the loop is there, you didn't change the fact that there is open end. So if I associate the fact that there is open end with some physical, say, charge, if I declare that, then that charge is always conserved, no matter what you do. This doesn't require any symmetry, so it's called super selection rule. And that is a conservation law induced from long-range entanglement. And surprisingly, if you perturb your system a little bit, it doesn't change too much because all the strings just got better a little bit. But at the long distance, it doesn't change. Okay, so let me recap. This simple example. So this is one way to make a so-called topological order or long-range entangled state. You take a superposition of states that are differed by a small loop deformations. And you can simply say that, oh, this is a loop condensate. Or more generally, you can just say, oh, some self-manifold condensate. And if you follow this line of thinking, then you all, especially in three dimensions, for example, then you have to condensate, say, one-dimensional object or two-dimensional object. But then it turns out that you must encounter some point-like objects, which can be thermally excited and which is not very good for our purpose of encoding quantum information reliably. So I ask, is this the only way? Can we do better? Or is this a complete picture of making long-range entangled state in a many-body setting? Where is my salted water? So I go to one higher dimensions. So, and I give you one particular, say, a design of interaction, my salted water. So to be concrete, I consider a simple cubic lattice with 2 qubits per site. Simple cubic lattice has nothing special. It's just you can always take any three-dimensional lattice, and by considering unit cell, you can always consider that as a simple cubic lattice. And this is my Hamiltonian. May look a bit crazy, but it is local Hamiltonian that involves only 8 body interaction, a finite number, around a cube. So let me spend some time to understand this diagram. So the Hamiltonian consists of 2 types of terms. And the one term is of sigma x and the other of sigma z, very similar to the previous loop condensate picture. And the arrangement of the sigma x operator looks in this diagram. I means absence and x means presence. And similarly for sigma z type. Okay, first question, what's the energy spectrum of this? Well, it's trivial actually. You see, suppose this term, well, without that part, this term consists of sigma x, so they trivially commute with each other. And this term commutes trivially with each other. What about this and that? They may not, but let's check. Suppose these 2 cubes meet along this point. Then there's a sigma x here, but there's no sigma z at the first qubit, so they trivially commute. They don't actually talk to each other. How about if the cube meets along this line, the edge? Well, there's a sigma z and sigma x, so they will anti-commute, but that minus sign will be canceled off by this x and that sigma z. What about when they meet along a face? Well, here's a sigma x and z. They do not meet. Here's another one, and they do not meet. So whatever combination you choose, you will always have an even number of overlap between sigma z and x. So Hamiltonian is commuting, and the energy spectrum is trivially just discrete integer values. Let me point out a symmetry of this diagram. The 111 axis is special than the other, and around that axis, it has a threefold rotation symmetry. Here, you know, zi, zi, zi are the same. And it has also a reflection symmetry between swapping this and that. And sigma z and x are related by spatial inversion. Okay, now I claim that whatever local operator you give me, if I consider the action on the ground space, then it is just a scalar multiplication. How can I prove such a thing? Well, you just decompose any local operator in terms of linear combination of Pauli matrices. Well, simply because Pauli matrices, you can write down any matrix. And then for each Pauli matrix, you show that this equality. It is either 0 or identical to the ground state projector. So local operator does nothing. And in particular, if you want to resolve your ground space, then local operator doesn't give you any information. And that is phrased as a local indistinguishability. Okay, what about degeneracy? Is there a non-trivial ground space? Well, I don't want to do the computation here, but here is the result that the degeneracy is always a power of 2, 2 to the some integer power k. But that k, as a function of system size, has a graph like this. This is not a random graph or some stochastic graph. This is an exact graph under periodic boundary conditions. Remember, we're working with the discrete lattices, so the graph doesn't look like a continuous curve. And in formula, it is this. So you have 3 polynomials decided by the system size, and you compute the, and then you factorize those polynomials into irreducible factors, compute the greatest common divisor, you read off the common factors, and you read off the degree of t as a polynomial. And that gives you the exponent of the degeneracy. There is a family where degeneracy is just constant, in this case just 4, or it grows exponentially in the linear system size. And the change can be dramatic as you can see here. If you increase the system size just 1, then it just drops to a very small one. Okay, then, well, what's the point of degeneracy if it's not going to be stable under perturbations? Surprisingly, the local indistinguishability, the fact that local observers do not have any information about the ground space, local operators have x on the ground space by scalar multiplication, that fact alone guarantees that your degeneracy will not split under perturbations. So if the horizontal axis is a perturbation strength and the vertical axis is your energy spectrum, then there is some splitting on the ground space, but that splitting is exponentially small in the system size. And the degeneracy doesn't matter in this analysis. More useful thing is that you can actually not only analyze the energy spectrum of these analyses, but also you can address what the operator is mapped when you consider the action on the ground space. And that is, there is some unitary transformation that preserves locality and preserves the action. So this is a powerful mathematical tool. Okay, now I declare that the ground state subspace is very non-trivial. Then how does the wave function look like? That's my second question. So let me try the similar thing as before. We consider the previous two-dimensional Hamiltonian as a superposition of small loops. Here I try the similar thing. But what I realize is that it is also a condensate of something, but that something does not have any meaningful or easy topological characterization. So some part of the component looks like a fractal, but it is not necessarily so because there are some deformations that I don't know how to characterize. So I would just simply call them as objects. So this representation doesn't teach us anything for this particular model. So what should we do? We should forget about something when something is too complicated. And there's a machinery how to forget in physics, and that's called the renormalization group flow. And when it comes to wave functions, and there's a particularly useful scheme, which is called entanglement RG. So let's go back to the two-dimensional to understand what's going on. So it's just a we coarse grind the lattice and remove the smallest loop in this case. In this case, the smallest blockhead, and left with, say 2x2 loops. And for that purpose, we have to apply some unitary transformation to get rid of the smallest loops, and then we will going to throw that away. And that composition of that those two transformation defines the entanglement RG. And it turns out that in two dimensions, all the exactly solvable modulus known so far corresponds to a fixed point under these transformations. And that leads you to a tensor network description of your ground state. So let me explain that a little bit. So you start with a qubit. I'm thinking of the inverse of the entanglement RG. So you start with a qubit, and then you apply these finite layer of local unitary transformation, and then you expand your lattice. And you insert more trivial degrees of freedom into the lattice, and you repeat the same thing until you get desired the size of wave function. And by saying that your wave function was a fixed point of entanglement RG just means that it has a mirror description of this type, where each layer, each step is similar to the previous one. So I do that transformation for my state. And the result is that, oh, I found the exact same copy. OK, so it qualifies for a representative of such a long-range entangled state. However, I encounter another pitch. That is also, this diagram is not too helpful. So I do the similar calculation. And what I found is that I obtain exact two copies of itself. So in the usual case, in the two dimensions or three dimensions in the conventional setting, these red dots were all trivial, were all just product state. But in this example, the red dots are, they themselves, interestingly, entangled. So I should not disregard them. And a bit mysterious, the red dot is actually a ground state of this slightly more complicated Hamiltonian, which has very similar properties as before. All right, and this finding gives you a tensor network description of the state, but it's different from the usual mirror because I had a branch every time I do the coarse graining. So you start with many qubits, not instead of just single qubit, and then you apply a finite layer of local unitary transformations, quantum circuits, and you expand the lattice. But you have to merge several such systems into one place before you do the next step, local basis change. So, and surprisingly, that tensor network was actually written in the similar time as I was writing this. Now, let's go to excited state. We have some understanding of the ground state of the 3D model. So let's go to excited states. The big claim here is that they're immobile. What do I mean by that? Let psi 1 be a particular excited state with the single particle at some location, and T be a translation operator, and O is arbitrary local observable, then matrix elements is identically zero whenever the translation is non-trivial. So there's no matrix elements that enables the hopping. So in figures, this is not allowed. But maybe this is allowed. And that has a consequence when you want to separate one excitation from the rest. So in the two-dimensional setting, there's no problem of separating one excitation from the rest. You can just apply a sequence of local moves, and that will separate it. In the 3D setting, you have to go through somewhat complicated fashion. So this is a three-dimensional version of CRP-Sinky triangle. So you might want to call it as a CRP-Sinky pyramid. And I want to isolate this single charge from the rest. And this is one of the optimal way to do that. you build up a small pyramid to create a four extensions, and then you do the similar thing at a different location to cancel off the nearby ones. And you do it self-similarly until you get a far separated ones. Okay, that leads you to when, and that leads you to some energy barrier to separate them. So on the left, I separate the charges by distance 8. And in the process, I needed 10 red dots, 10 excitations in the intermediate step. But if I want to separate distance 32, then I need 2 red dots more than before. So there is a logarithmic energy cost that you have to pay into the system in order to do the separation. And that is also one new mechanism for localization, which is a hot topic these days. So let me remind you the two-dimensional setting again. The presence of the open end, that thing only mattered, but not its precise position. And the reason for that was that the detecting operator intersected that flux insertion operator at a point. So you get information from that point, and that's the only information you can tell about the endpoints. And that's why the position didn't matter. But in this case, since the separation operator or insertion operator does not have a string-like support, it has some larger support. So any detection operator should intersect them at more than one point. And that information is sufficient to determine the actual location inside. Right, well, just reiterating what I said before, there are many detection operators, whether there's a charge or not, around that excitation, and that those informations are all non-trivial, and in combination, they can tell the position inside. So one interpretation is that the position itself actually a topological charge for an excitation. And that property, thanks to the mathematical tools I briefly mentioned before, is robust under perturbations. And indeed, the precise analysis tells that whatever perturbation you give me, there exists an excited state with the localized energy profile, such that when you evolve the system under that perturbation, then it behaves almost like an eigenstate. So, and there are a lot of such states. So in this particular model, the closed system dynamics doesn't make the system thermalize in the low energy limit. Okay, then how about braiding? Well, we love to talk about braiding when it comes to topological order. So here is a movie. So I separate one charge from the rest using that operator. And then I bring back through another route and recombine them until it gets annihilated. So on the side view, effectively, I have moved this particle from this position around that loop and recombined it. So there's a hole coming into that. I have braided one particle around that pole. Here the shape of the operator is not important. It can be deformed a little bit. And one way of saying that is your antiparticle must be extended as you push the antiparticle away from the particle, which is very unusual from a usual perspective. Okay, let me get back to the original motivating question. What do we mean by quantum memory? How can we ask about it? How can we analyze that? So, and how can we ask about coherence time mathematically? So I start with some ground state, and let them evolve with the interaction under a thermal bath, and then I apply some map based on this state, regardless of this thermal evolution. The time evolved state from one particular state by a thermal evolution will never be like a ground state. It will almost always be orthogonal to the original. So it doesn't make sense to compare rho t and rho naught when you address the coherence question. You have to apply a certain map that is independent of your evolution, and then you compare the two. And that's, I think, the most precise way whether the system has a memory of the past. And we have devised such a map for this particular model. Actually, it works better than that, but and found that the relaxation time or coherence time grows with the system size up to a certain critical system size. And this is analytical lower bound, and this is numerical simulation supporting that. The horizontal axis is the linear system size, and the vertical axis is the coherence time. And the red means high temperature, blue means low temperature. So for small system sizes, it grows with some power law whose exponent is proportional to the inverse temperature, but it somehow levels off after system size. Why does it level off? Because the system allows point-like particles. So if you compute the entropy factor, that the number of configurations, where the point-like particles can be located, then that always wins the logarithmic energy barrier. Okay, let me compare that with the conventional 2D, two-dimensional or three-dimensional topological order. In those cases, there's no system size dependence at all. You can achieve longer coherence time by lowering the temperature, but that's it. So it is a qualitatively different system. And I have specifically told you about one particular one, but there is I would say model factory to generate models with the similar behaviors. They seem to all go beyond the usual paradigm of topological quantum field theory, and they usually contain immobile point-like excitations, and the behavior of those point-like excitations depend on your situation. Okay, so let me just comment about the development of the topological order. Typically, it has been discussed using so-called modular functor. It means you are provided with some topological manifold, and you write down a Lagrangian on top of that, which is insensitive to the geometry of that manifold. And then that action gives rise to some finite dimensional Hilbert space. So mathematically, you're associating a manifold with boundaries with the vector spaces and linear transformations on that. And lattice versions was more or less discretization of those continuous theories. On the other hand, if you want to see the topological order as a coarsest structure of some gap system, then this Hamiltonian should not be ignored. Just a plain local Hamiltonian, translation invariant, which is gapped, stable to the perturbations, but somehow it contains non-integer operator inside it. It has its topological particles remembers its position. Some weird thing is happening there. Oh, I'm sorry, I speak too fast before I go into the slides. So yeah, in the usual modular functor paradigm, we have been talking about superselection sector, topological charge, or degeneracy, fusion, braiding, topological spin, and so on. But most of them actually fails in this in this model. And this has, this it should be considered seriously as a stable properties of cat phases. Okay, so let me just conclude. I have told you about how entanglement hides some degree of freedom from local observers. In the simplest case of Bell pair, the relative phase factor is completely hidden from either party. And in fact, you can push it further to make a slightly more complicated entangled state in such a way that the global phase, global amplitude information is completely hidden, including the magnitude and phase are completely hidden from local observers. And as a consequence of those, the access to those global amplitude information was possible through many different ways. And being many different ways, that leads you to an emergent conservation law, which we call as a superselection rule. But if you consider that superselection rule even further and strictly stick with that concept, then you discover very interesting gap space in three dimensions. So that might be my salty water for future technologies. So thank you for listening.
So the 2D example you gave, it's related to a gauge theory.
Yes.
Set to gauge theory. So there, it doesn't look like there's any local field theory for your 3D example because of this funny degeneracy function.
Yeah.
But so you would you agree, or is there any chance that there's something, you know, higher gauge theory is off, but it doesn't seem to be much higher gauge theory.
The sensible conclusion might be that because of the high degeneracy or from the perspective of entanglement RG transformation, the number of fields should increase.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's sites.
Right.
So okay. So it's yeah. The example.
Right.
But there is a local sort of gauge symmetry as well, right?
So yes.
It's just more complicated.
Right. There is a local symmetry. You can think of the model as that.
Is it related to higher gauge theory, which is kind of
maybe? Not necessarily, because in higher gauge theory, you assume that your gauge transformation takes some propulsion form.
Yeah,
I mean,
it is actually something kind of on cubes. It's on cubes.
Yeah, yeah, but the detail of the geometry is very important.
Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to ask a question that you raised. That does long-range entanglement always imply some kind of non-trivial topology, or not so? I don't know, that question wants a little unanswered.
The converse direction is okay. I mean, whenever you have a conserved quantity that is topological, then you always have long-range entanglement. I mean, you require, you must have a deep quantum circuit to generate that state. That I can say for sure. But the other direction, not so clear.
So you mentioned that entanglement entropy is not a good detector for this kind of long-range entanglement, at least it's when used naively. So do you have some sort of quantitative measure?
For this 3D thing?
Yeah, so just more generally for long-range entanglements.
So I have thought about that, and I actually wrote a paper about that. But the sensible thing and rigorous thing I can say actually boils down to the class of conventional things. For this, when you have an extensive number of topological charges, then I can't say for sure whether the quantities I compute will be stable. Well, for example,
stable under what, small perturbation?
Yes.
But you have some proposal, is it?
So I have, right. So there is a way to unambiguously define what the topological charges are, given a Hamiltonian or given a wave function. But that that is through some algebraic construction that is usually finite dimensional when applied to the conventional thing, but it becomes infinite dimensional applied to the thing. So yeah, I can talk to you.
Okay. I'm wondering how important this dimension here. Can you build up similar models in 2D?
Good question. I don't know. I doubt it. So in the, say, in the class of commuting Hamiltonians, all the concrete examples belong to that class. In that case, you are guaranteed to have only finite number of topological charges. And that implies that the position should not be regarded as a topological charge. So your usual picture in two dimensions hold. But if you do not assume that, I'm working on it.
Sorry, can I ask you?
How do you think physically, from an RG point of view, of, about this branching? How should I think when things branch? And typically, I cross-plane, and get to a critical point. But here, there is this branching. What's the physical meaning of it?
Well, like I commented before, that when you want to consider as a field theory, then it seems to imply that your number of fields should increase when you go to longer and longer distances. And formally, you should take an infinite if you want to talk about fixed point. Originally, the branching mirror was proposed to capture entanglement entropy, which goes beyond the area law. If you naively take the mirror network, and then in the higher dimension, like two or three dimensions, then entanglement entropy obeys always a strict area law without any logarithmic corrections. But this one still obeys the area law, so that motivation doesn't really help here. It's still perplexing.
Because there's also this picture of getting to this meta from renormalizing the lattice, right? This mm-hmm. stuff that you don't put the lattice from the beginning, but you start cross-graining and the
yes.
lattice appears. So for which models I would start doing this procedure, and instead of getting a usual meta, I would get this branching meta for your model. That's what you're saying. If I would apply this logic to your model, instead of finding the usual meta, I would find this branching meta.
Yeah, yeah.
There's nothing simple that can be said about it, or is it? It just looks very.
One thing is that in the entanglement RG, there's no energy consideration. It's only about entanglement structure. But the extra piece I couldn't get rid of because it is also interestingly entangled, equally complicated. So when we consider some energetics into it, and what will happen, that's an open question.
So do you know of any physical systems which can realize
this?
I don't know. Many fields?
That's the hard question.
Sorry, related to the previous question. So, you had this huge difference in the generosity. If you change L by 1, suddenly instead of 2 to the L, it was 2. The pictures that you showed, are they sensitive to this, to changing L by 1? This big picture, for example, do they exist in some case? But as you change L by 1, they disappear?
This one?
Yeah.
Yes, it is sensitive to that. I mean, or that particular diagram can only grow by factor of 2. So
if I change L by 1, it disappears, this diagram?
Right, this diagram is an operator that acts on the ground space. So if you want to plug it into to the p plus 1, then this operator will not map ground state to ground state. Mm-hmm.
Speaking of physically realizable systems, I think you mentioned the other day you had thought a little bit about 4 plus 1 dimensional analogs.
Yes.
Of this, maybe I should have said unrealizable. do you have any comments or anything interesting to tell us about that case?
Well, four-dimensional model is that involves, I believe, 6 spot interactions. So it's slightly less complicated than that. That, well, 6 is smaller than 8, but it's in 4 dimensions. So. This is just a mathematical model with no direct connection to the realistic components.
But are there any new, like there were new phenomena in 3+1, mm-hmm. this extended antiparticle or whatever. Mm-hmm. Is there any qualitatively different thing that happened in 4+1?
So it's, well, information is higher, so it's hard to explain, but so in 4 dimensions, you can actually get rid of point like ones and left with some flux-like stations, which are topological, meaning that you can detect the presence of flux going around the far, far away loop. But you can make it those flux rigid. So in 4 dimensions, you can make those flux to be rigid. It becomes hard to deform. So that's another.
So it localizes a loop instead of a quark,
right,
or something.
Right.
So.
Okay, and let's thank everyone again.